Good afternoon and welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. It's a great day in South Carolina. It's a great day every day in South Carolina. As long as it's not raining, right? Hey, you know what made my day or made my week? There, if you were at the Bassmaster Classic last year on Hartwell, and I believe we did this on Sunday morning. It was Championship Sunday we did this. A friend of mine who owns Venture Aviation out at Greenville Downtown Airport, David Knobloch, his wife Lori, is the one who who kind of pinned me in a corner about this show when I was starting it back in 2014. David's a pilot, a big pilot. I mean, you know, corporate biz jets. I mean, he does it all. But he bought a Stearman, PT-17. I think it's a 1946 model. Blue, yellow wings, big, you know, the old star emblem on the wings and all. And it's got a smoke system. So last year when the Classic was coming to town, excuse me, I said, you know, I said, it'd be really cool to do something over Lake Hartwell with a Stearman. So just kind of under the radar, we didn't tell Bass about this at all. Under the radar, kind of talked to Dave and said, hey, let's do this. He goes, man, he said, this is going to be tough. He says, that's before the time change, and we need to be on site at like 7:20 or something, and sun doesn't come up. It's going to be tight getting the airplane from Greenville to Anderson that morning, pick you up at the Anderson Airport. But we made it work. It was iffy. I mean, we were sitting there looking at the clock going, okay, he left Greenville. How did he leave Greenville? It's pitch black out here, you know, because he didn't have lights on the plane. We did all that. We were 40 seconds late coming over the landing on Championship Sunday. And there were a few pictures taken. I haven't seen a whole lot of them. We did have to let Bass know because we had to get the drones out of the way. We didn't want to come over Green Pond Landing and smack into a drone. But one of my friends, Neil Paul from Visit Anderson, was down at Bass headquarters in Birmingham, Alabama. And in the hallway at Bass headquarters is a picture of the launch, you know, the ramp, the launch, all the boats, and us coming across it, smoke on. That's just this job is fun, if you call it a job. Having something like that is just icing on the cake. Just cool. That was fun. Should have been inverted, though. But we didn't have parachutes, so we were right side up. That just made my week and month and everything else. What is free-range parenting? You know, we grew up with free-range parenting. We left the house in the morning after chores were done. And, you know, as long as you're back by dinner time, everything was cool. Because, you just roamed. Well, in South Carolina, I thought that was hilarious because I get tons of this stuff about benefits to outdoors. Kids need to be outside and all this. And I just thought this was interesting. What is free-range parenting? New South Carolina bill could change the way you raise your kids. You ready for this? Parents in South Carolina can get in trouble with the law if they leave their kids in a parked car or let them play in a park by themselves. But a new law in the state Senate wants to change that, clarifying the rules to say kids who are old enough and mature enough don't always have to have adult supervision. I won't say we were mature enough. I mean, how mature is it to ride your bike down the road with no hands on the handlebars? You know, mature, nah, but, you know, if it hurt enough when you crashed, you probably wouldn't do it again, although we did. But but this is interesting. Utah made national headlines when lawmakers approved its free-range parenting law last year. New York Times reported the Utah law, like the proposal for South Carolina, says kids who are mature enough can walk to school or a park or wait in a car while parents run errands, according to the Times. The bill up for debate in Columbia would change the state's child abuse and neglect standards, clarifying the rules for law enforcement and the State Department of Social Services, according to the Free Times. This is not saying you treat your child badly, Vince Sheehan, Democrat candidate, told the newspaper, but allowing some freedom for your children before they're adults is not neglect. Can't believe I'm agreeing with him. Sheehan, who introduced the bill, said parents can use common sense to give children more freedom and independence, according to the Free Times. Clearly, you shouldn't leave a kid in a car that's 100 degrees, but if your kid is 12 and you run into the store and it's 50 or 60 degrees outside, I mean, my parents did that, didn't they all? The change to the law states child abuse and neglect or harm does not occur if the parent, guardian, or other person responsible for the child's welfare permits the child whose basic needs are met and who is of sufficient age and maturity to avoid harm or unreasonable risk of harm to engage in independent activities. These activities include walking to school, nearby store or park, playing outside, waiting in a car, staying home alone. Oh, God. This is great. I mean, you know, I laugh at it and all. But it's true. Utah is the only state to pass a free-range parenting law. A similar bill was introduced in Arkansas but not passed the state house in 2017. There is a lot of truth to that. I mean, you know, helicopter parents. You know, we've moved on from helicopter parents to something else. I forget what the new one is. But it's the truth. Kids need, they need that, they need the freedom. They need a little bit of independence, a little accountability before you turn them loose, you know, with a car at 16. It's a fact. Anyway, I think it's a pretty good thing. But what do I know? Calendar for this week brought to you by Visit Anderson Green Pond Landing and Event Center. Big game dinner. The second annual big game dinner, Saturday, February the 2nd, 5:30 p.m. Andrews Church of God in Andrews, South Carolina. Sponsored by Men of War Men's Ministry Department. Guest speaker is Phil Thompson, International Director for Men and Women of Action. Of course, they're going to have all sorts of food. You can guarantee you that. So Andrews, South Carolina, if you're around that area, it's something for you to go to. The same day, February the 2nd, 2019, in Chester County, they're having the NWTF Chapter's Hunting Heritage Banquet at 6 o'clock at the Gateway Conference Center in Richburg, South Carolina. More information on this can be had at the National Wild Turkey Federation website, or you can probably go on Facebook and look for Chester County Hunting Heritage Banquet. Anyway, the easiest place to do is go to the National Wild Turkey Federation. I think it's Get Involved or Events. Pick an event in your state, and from there. For those photographers out there, this is a pretty fun one. The Harry Hampton Memorial Wildlife Fund Photo Contest. The deadline is February the 15th. So you've got, what, about 2-3 weeks to go to get your entry in? Photos of all ages, photographers of all ages and skill levels are welcome to enter a total of 2 images in the contest. Resolution size is addressed. Prints will not be accepted, only digital images. 5 o'clock, February 15th. You got to have them all in. They do say here you can't manipulate too much because it could disqualify you. Now, what too much is, I don't have a clue. But it does say entries exhibiting excessive use of content manipulation, such as composite images or other image manipulations, including but not limited to colorizing or use of digital effects, may be disqualified. I guess that's the HDR filter on your iPhone. You're going to have a gallery at the top 100 pictures will be chosen by judges. Winning images will be printed and mounted by South Carolina Wildlife Magazine and displayed at the Palmetto Sportsman Classic March 22nd to 24th at the fairgrounds. It was something. A lot of these are used on social media by South Carolina Wildlife as the picture of the day. Submissions that maybe didn't win are up there, and you see them, they're great pictures. So anyway, how to enter. You need to send an email to photocontest@dnr.s. Siri just popped up here. Siri, go away. My Siri is Australian. My kids change it, and I don't know how to change it back, so sorry about that. Siri, I don't know. And my phone was just laying there. I did not touch my phone. She's very sensitive these days. She thinks I'm talking to her. She must be lonely. Send an email to photocontest@dnr.sc.gov with the following required information: photographer's name, complete mailing address, email address, photo description, photo location, and the category you wish to enter. There are 4 categories: wildlife, birds, recreation, scenic landscapes. They're going to have awards for first, second, third place in each category, and 1 Harry Hampton Best of Show award. And you do give up your rights to the picture once you've submitted it. So for your photographers, there you go. All right, hang on through the break. We're gonna talk a little Steve Rinella, meat eater, and then we got Michael Hook at the bottom of the hour talk about habitat. So hang on. More Woods and Water, South Carolina, on the other side of the break. I currently have put Siri in timeout. I have no idea. She just wanted to be part of the show. Everybody's welcome. Hey, even if you're asking, what do you want me to do? oh, man. Oh, if you have not heard, there's one guest that I've had on the show one time. And you know, I met him at a National Deer Alliance conference on CWD. I think it was actually a joint Quality Deer Management Association National Deer Alliance meeting in Louisville, Kentucky. And I talked to him that evening. Just a great guy. Even if he is from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, one of my best friends is from the UP. We've been friends ever since high school. So I kind of know how to talk to him. We struck up a conversation. He was on the show one time. And Steve Rinella is his name. He is the guy behind Meat Eater. And there was an article published in the Federalist that the anti-Democrats were, I mean, the anti-Second Amendment folks, Peter Chernin, in fact, were going to take over Meat Eater. That it was all over, that it was going to be, you know, just a liberal think tank from here on out. And Steve came through and had a rebuttal. I emailed him and didn't expect to hear back from him because he's so busy. But he came out with a 6-minute, 40-second response, which I think is great. It's straightforward. If you're a Meat Eater guy, this ought to put you on at ease. If you don't know about Meat Eater, maybe you need to look into it because he's a great guy, Steve Rinella. So let's listen to his response and just listen. It's good.
This is Steven Rinella from Meat Eater. Considering the business I'm in, I half expect to wake up every day to learn that I'm under attack for my celebration of hunting, either from the radical left who are concerned about my promotion of firearms ownership through the positive portrayal of hunters on my TV show or podcast, or from elements of the animal rights movement who are disgusted by the fact that I not only choose to kill my own dinner, but provide information and insight to help others do the same thing. So I was pretty surprised to find out this week that the exact opposite is happening and that me and my company, Meat Eater Inc., are being attacked from the right. The gist is that Meat Eater, quote, sold out to the Chernin Group, an investment group that was founded by Peter Chernin. Mr. Chernin has taken some stands on gun control issues that are concerning to our audience, and they're worried that our content or viewpoints will somehow be manipulated in ways that are damaging to the interests of gun owners and hunters. First off, Meat Eater hasn't been sold. From its inception as a television show in 2010, I owned Meat Eater as a joint venture with 0.0 Production, a New York-based company that has now produced over 100 episodes of our show. Last year, I took on the investment from TCG without taking anything off the table in order to expand Meat Eater in meaningful ways that would allow us to produce more content in the hunting, fishing, conservation, and culinary spaces, and to continue inspiring thousands of new hunters to equip themselves and take to the field. The Chernin Group is a for-profit concern. Their investment model allows companies to build their own teams and operate autonomously. Mr. Chernin has a long career, both operating and owning media and editorial outlets. It's worth noting that these include Fox News and Barstool Sports, where he hasn't even remotely inserted personal opinion. While I may disagree with some of Mr. Chernin's personal views on policy issues, if you're looking for an apology from me for making this move, you're not going to get it. I retain full creative control of Meat Eater, Inc., and 3 of our 5 board seats are held by me, my longtime creative partner at 0.0, and our CEO, outdoor business veteran Kevin Sloan, who successfully ran the apparel company Sitka Gear for many years. I have spent my entire career working with people in the media space who have no or little familiarity with our lifestyle, and it's a point of pride of mine that I have worked successfully with them to put out the content and messaging that I want to put out. If we're going to protect the future of hunting and the shooting sports, we need to grow them beyond the same base that we currently have. We don't need all of them to become participants, but we do need to maintain a majority who understand our culture and support it. Today, media is the way that you make that happen, and doing it requires leveraging that industry to tell stories and share perspectives that resonate. I've done that through work with everything ranging from the New York Times to Travel Channel. Without this approach, you're leaving the messaging around hunting and guns to those who traffic only in bogus stereotypes and campaigns of misinformation that put us in a position where we can only be defensive and reactionary. Now, I obviously care about these accusations enough to collect my thoughts here and present them in a carefully worded way, so don't think for a moment that I'm unfazed by this. I support the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms is deeply important to me, and it's non-negotiable. I've been a proud and responsible gun owner for my entire life. I'm bringing my kids up in the same way. I have never supported or endorsed any bans on classifications of guns or limits on ammunition possession or any other attempts to infringe on our constitutional liberties. As a hunter, I might choose a different suite of tools for hunting than you would choose for yourself. My choice of rifle shouldn't be taken as condemnation of yours, and your choice shouldn't be dictated by what I choose. I have friends and colleagues who hunt with ARs, and I'll rib those guys with the same affection that I rib my buddies who hunt with long bows. The sensitivities around this issue are getting out of control, in my view, as the snowflake culture expands into unexpected spaces. With that said, I'm also unapologetically in favor of an open exchange of ideas on any and all subjects that impact hunters and anglers. I have interviewed and showcased a wide array of voices from across the political spectrum. There have been plenty of conservatives in there, as well as some liberals. I take that as another point of pride. The only politician to ever come on Meat Eater, the TV show, is Governor Matt Mead, a Republican from Wyoming, a man who I respect and admire a great deal. He's also been on the Meat Eater podcast. Besides Governor Mead, the only other politicians to come on the Meat Eater podcast were Senator Martin Heinrich, a Democrat, and Congressman Rob Bishop, a Republican. Heinrich's an avid hunter. Bishop is not. Trust me, this balance is not accidental, nor is it accidental that less than 1% of our TV shows and only around 2% of our podcast episodes feature a politician at all. You're not going to see that ratio change, but I am warning you that if I do have a politician on the show, there is a chance that it's going to be a Democrat who hunts and owns guns. If we share those interests, I'm sure going to engage with them. If you think we're going to be better off when that party is dominated by socialist vegans with who we have no interactions or common ground, you better spend some time figuring out a better way to think. Regardless of what I say here, I know that some number of Meat Eater fans out there are going to tune us out from now on. That's disappointing, but I accept it. I'm confident, though, that Meat Eater will continue to expand its audience by staying true to the fact that we love the outdoors, regard it as sacred, and believe that interactive relationships with the natural world enhance all of our lives. Those are ideas that I believe in promoting, and I'll talk about them with anyone who cares to listen, regardless of their background or biases. And the way that I talk about it is no mystery. I've written 6 books and dozens upon dozens of articles, filmed 7 seasons of a TV show, and recorded over 150 podcast episodes. Our podcast network, which includes Ben O'Brien's The Hunting Collective, puts out multiple shows a week, dozens of social media posts a week, and nearly endless stream of written and video content. Please, go dig into as much of it as you'd like. What you're going to find is a company who values wildlife, hunting, and the freedom of expression. We would happily take a bullet for any of those things. And nothing and no one is going to change that.
I think the explanation was fairly self-explanatory. It's a partnership. You know, he's expanding. April Vokey's on there doing some fly fishing stuff. He's still doing the Meat Eater podcast. I guess you have to take him at his word. And knowing Steve Rinella as much as I do, I think you can pretty much rely on it. If it did one thing, I'm trying to think where I was. I was on the road going somewhere. And towards the end of 17, and I wanted to get him back on the show, and we were talking. I called him on the road, and we were talking, and he said, man, he says, I am just so busy. He said, I'm doing podcasts and traveling. He said, I just don't know how much time I've got. He said, can we visit this? Let me get through this hunt and visit. And I just, you know, he's a busy guy, and I'm just a one guy, a little radio show here in South Carolina. So I didn't push it. From time to time, I email him. He'll respond. You know, I just ask him a question or a comment on something he's done on one of the podcasts, on one of the shows. And so we kept up relationship. Well, I emailed him about the original article. I said, just help me out here. And that was on a Friday, last Friday. Saturday, I believe this came out, January 17th. Is that 5 days ago, 7 days ago? Yeah. So it came out on the Friday. No, the article came out on Friday, the 17th, and his response came out a day or two later. And Sunday afternoon, I was home, and my email, boop, and it was Steve Rinella. And he said, well, could read the email too if I had it up. Anyway, he said, I'm sorry, I wanted to respond to you. He said, but I didn't have my own thoughts together yet. And I said, no problem. I got the response, and it's just what I expected from you. And I said, you know, if you want to waste 15 minutes of your life anytime in the future, let me know. We'll do something else. He goes, absolutely. He said, man, I'd love to come back on the show. And he says, as long as we don't have to talk about this. And I said, well, hey, it's, you know, whatever you want to talk about. So it is, it's going to be fun. We're going to have Steve Rinella back on. We're working, we're tossing around a couple ideas of what we want to do. I don't want to do the same old thing, you know, asking some questions and having him respond with whatever's the latest and greatest or whatever. So we're working on something a little different for his next visit to the show, but that's going to be fun. So keep your heads up for that one. I'll be sure to give, you know, plenty of time so you can get clear your Saturday afternoon to listen to that one. Cause he is just a great guy, and you hear it in his voice. I mean, he is just passionate about the outdoors. And so we're going to do some fun stuff with that one sometime here in the next few weeks. I also got Dr. Grant Woods. If you haven't been keeping up with this, you know, we have CWD that popped up in Tennessee, CWD that popped up in Alabama. And it's one of those things that, you know, the more you look, the more you find. Well, they've had mandatory testing in Tennessee since December the 29th, and they've discovered an additional 62 confirmed cases of CWD in, you know, less than a month. So not good. Grant and I talked about that one. He's going to come on. He's not a scientist. He's a habitat manager. He'll tell you that first off, but he knows so much, and he talks about it so well. So Grant's going to come on. Going to have Steve Rinella on. It's going to be, and I'm already having to reschedule things in February and March, and it's just bizarre. Hey, look, if you're into kayaking and canoeing, and you're always looking for a good map, Blue Wave Mapping by Upstate Forever, they're available. They're waterproof. They got them for the Chaga River, the Paclet and Lawson's Fork Blue Way, Tiger River Blue Way, the Upper Saluda River Blue Way, the Upper Saluda River Blue Way. Map number two. They got two maps of that one. The Broad River Blue Way, 12 Mile River, Ennery River Blue Way. And you can find them all at gopaddlesc.com. Always be prepared to have a map. All right, look. Got Michael Hook from DNR. I'm going to talk about quail habitat, Bob White Quail Initiative, a whole bunch of other stuff. Hang on for more Woods and Water on the other side of the break. He's teasing us with summertime stuff now, Jimmy Buffett. You don't play that stuff in January. Gets everybody all torn up. Oh, man. Well, welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. It is, there's always a lot going on. I can't make half the stuff I want to make. But at times when I do make stuff, make events and seminars and all, a lot of times it's outdoors. A lot of times it involves bird dogs. Bob White Quail, which is near and dear to my heart, and Habitat. And it seems like one of the guys I always run into these things is Michael Hook. Michael, how does that happen?
we must run in the same circle.
It's a good circle, if you ask me. But Michael Hook, who is the small game program leader with the Department of Natural Resources, is with us on Woods and Water. And we're going to hit on a few topics, including the announcement that DNR came out with a few weeks back, that they're now in a partnership with U.S. Forest Service, South Carolina Forestry, on a 10-year conservation plan. Tell us a little bit about that one, Michael.
Yeah, we were really excited about that. This is sort of a long time in the making, really.
Sure.
We've been wanting to help out the Forest Service. The issue is we've got a quail focal area.
Right.
Over in the Newberry County area.
Okay.
And it takes a long time for those federal guys to get through the red tape and paperwork and all that to get some forest management done. So just
okay.
The simple things like adding fire breaks, cutting timber, all that, it takes them a while to do.
Okay.
It does not take the DNR quite as long because we don't have to jump through as many hoops.
Sure.
So there's a process where we can become good neighbors to the Forest Service. And so we signed a joint agreement with us and Forest Service and Forestry Commission to become, and it's really called the Good Neighbor Authority. And so, like I say, you know, it allows us to get more quail habitat on the ground.
Okay.
It allows the Forest Service to get work done faster. And like I say, the birds benefit because, hey, all of a sudden they've got new places to range.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this then. A couple months ago, a bunch of us met up down in Whitmire. Y'all put on a field day. We went around and toured a couple of private pieces of property where they were doing some habitat management, mostly timber cutting and getting it ready for good quail habitat. And then we visited one of those focal points. And it was great habitat from what we were seeing there, which was a lot of open, grass, you know, with some mature pine trees mixed in it.
Sort of a pine savanna.
Yeah, a pine savanna. Is that the end result? Is that where we're going with this? Is hoping to get more of that in the national forest?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. That area, the Indian Creek, area right around the Whitmire office.
Right.
That was sort of designated as a National Bobwhite Conservation Initiative, quail focal area. And the idea is exactly that, to create some connectivity between those already established, you know, areas that look like what you're describing, that mm-hmm. open pineland,
right.
and try to create more connectivity, try to create more habitat. And, hopefully we'll get that accomplished through this Good Neighbor Authority. Because like I say, they've got a lot of trees marked over there that's been marked for a couple of years. And,
okay.
and it just, like I say, it just takes time to get them on the ground. So we're trying to speed that up a little bit.
And that's where the Forestry Commission comes in. They can come in and take those logs out for the U.S. Forest Service in a more timely manner.
That's correct. Like I say, you know, they'll most likely subcontract it out to other folks. But, yeah, I mean, they're in the same boat that we are. That our processes are a little less tenuous. It's not near as much paperwork.
Right, sure.
And so we can, for example, just have a 6 month or a 12 month, timber contract and, you know, we'll have those trees hitting the ground fairly quickly.
Okay.
And
this is going to happen on all of our national forest land, whether it's Sumter, Francis Marion. This encompasses it was 630. I think they added, a couple of hundred thousand or down along the Francis Marion. So it's probably around 700,000 acres now.
We've got in my shop where we're dealing with quail, you know, we work on the Sumter there around Ennery. We work
right.
on over in the Lick Fork area around Edgefield and McCormick.
Okay.
We also are working down on the Francis Marion. We started working with the biologist down there. The Price's Landing area, we're hoping to do some of this quail work as well.
So, nice.
And that's probably a 5,000 or 6,000 acre tract that we're looking at down there. So,
okay.
Yeah, but no, it's statewide. And theoretically, we could do it on the Andrew Pickens up in the mountains, and that might would help our little grouse up
yeah.
there. So.
Hey, now there's an unintended consequence when you manage for small game. You manage for everything.
You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely, everybody benefits.
That's it. You know, it's there are a lot of people, a lot of deer hunters that go through a lot of trouble every year. I mean, we're already in the planning stages, you know, okay, we need to back this edge up a little bit. I need to straighten this line out so I can get corn in there and soybeans and whatever else. And we do it for the deer, but man, the benefits to all small game and even birds. I noticed because I plant sunflower.
Oh, absolutely.
And boy, I tell you, when those sunflowers get ready to go. You got bees buzzing around there. You got butterflies buzzing around there. You got the yellow finches are everywhere. I mean, it's amazing what happens when you manage not just for deer, but you manage with deer in mind. But the exponential benefits to the wildlife is immeasurable.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's a good article that I think the Missouri QDMA put out. It was written by Craig Harper, and it talked about managing fallow fields for deer. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was really solely focused on deer, but the way they were going about it was, like I say, letting the areas grow fallow, doing some winter disking, doing a little bit of prescribed burning, and you were creating that rough area. Well, they were creating quail habitat. Sure. They were creating rabbit habitat. They were creating bee habitat, butterfly habitat, and it is. It's amazing. Everything uses that early successional species or that early successional habitat, and like I say, it really does benefit across the across the whole ecosystem. You know, in our monitoring, we monitor six other bird species along with the bobwhite.
That's right, you do. Tell us which ones those are, because it's kind of funny, some of the names.
Yeah. Well, you've got the brown-headed nuthatch.
There you go.
The indigo bunting. No, excuse me, blue grosbeak.
Okay.
Eastern meadowlark.
Yep.
Field sparrow.
One more, and I don't know it.
Bachman sparrow.
Bachman sparrow. That's it.
Yep.
Because all those habitats, if you find one of those in a habitat, you're going to find the others. They all like the same thing.
That's correct. And you know, those the nine game birds tend to show up a little bit quicker. So when you do this work, they're usually the first ones in there. You know, it takes the quail a little bit longer to get in, but I mean, usually you can see a bump in their populations fairly immediately.
Okay.
And you can look at their population graph over the last 80 years, and I mean, you can lay it over the bobwhites, and it's almost identical. They've exhibited the same decline over the last 80 years that bobwhites have, and it's all related to habitat. But, but like I say, I mean, they're usually the first to respond. When you go in, open up here, create some grass, some savanna or what have you, They're there. They respond quickly.
You know, probably four of those species, four of the five that you named, other than the quail, probably nobody knows about or keeps track of. But as a kid growing up in South Carolina, meadowlarks, they were everywhere. I mean, in the wintertime at our place in the country, I mean, there were just flocks of them flying around. You know, we had broomstraw fields,
Open cow pastures.
And boy, I tell you, when the quail started to decline, the meadowlarks went away. I bet it's been close to 10, 15 years since I've seen a meadowlark.
Yeah. Like I say, they've exhibited a lot of the same problems. Right? Loggerheaded trike is the same thing. I mean, you know, these birds, they're using those same habitats that the quail are using, and once that habitat disappears, all the birds disappear.
Well, you hit on something there that we talked about, that we want to talk about a little bit. That's prescribed burning. And we got about 3 minutes to go or so. You know, a lot of people, boy, you talk about burning. I've got a friend who lives in California, and his wife, we started a big bonfire one day and sent her a picture, and she about had a cow. Because, you know, it's just, you don't do that in California. But here in the Southeast, fire is probably one of the best tools. Can I go so far as to say best tools for creating that open savanna type habitat?
Yeah, I would be right there along next to you saying that. You know, it's certainly one of the cheapest ways to achieve that effect. It's one of the easiest. You know, there's obviously some considerations to be taken. You know, with fire, anytime you mess with fire, it can be dangerous.
Sure,
but it's the cheapest, it's the easiest. You can really make a difference on your landscape with just a little bit of fire. And most often you're working your landscape with that fire at a time when you're not busy doing something else. It's not the middle of spring planting, or it's not the middle of deer season, or, you know, what have you. It's the downtime, and it's pretty enjoyable work. You know, it's like I say, it's fun to get out there with some of your buddies and get some fire going. And like I say, you're doing a lot for the environment, but like I say, it's fun work.
Real quick here, what are you looking for when you're looking to control burn? I mean, we got pine trees, so we're looking at burning sections of pine trees and stuff like that. Is that mainly what you're going to be working with in South Carolina? Can you do that with hardwoods too?
You can do it with hardwoods. Absolutely. I've got a working with a landowner right now that's trying to create an oak savanna. And, he's been fairly successful. You can do some patch burning in fields of native warm season grasses and create some really cool, habitats for quail. I mean, there's a diversity of species out in these old fields that you just don't think about. You look in an old cow pasture and go, gosh, you know, that's a lot of fescue, and you'll see a piece of broom straw here and there, and lo and behold, when you start burning it, it's just amazing what pops up, all the wildflowers and all. I mean, that fire just exposes a lot of seed for one, but it also scarifies seed, and like I say, some of that seed's just laying there dormant waiting for that interaction, and boy, when it goes through, it takes off. But yeah, I mean, pine savannas are where everybody thinks about it, but there's room to be burned in oak savannas and out in the fields. And yeah, like I say, the key to it is doing small blocks.
Okay.
I tell landowners, you know, you think about your quail when you're doing this work. You know, always have a place for them to go. You know, you want to do it close.
Sure, sure.
So you don't want to burn up their house.
All right, well, let's take a break. We've got a couple more things we want to talk about. More with Michael Hook and Woods and Water South Carolina on the other side. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Got Michael Hook from the Department of Natural Resources with us. And we're talking a little habitat, a little quail. Touched on the new partnership that we've got with the Forestry Commission, U.S. Forest Service, trying to create some more habitat. And prescribed burning, you know, now's the time, right, Michael? It's the springtime of the year. Humidity levels are just right. You're not in that nesting breeding season. Where does somebody go? I mean, I know where to go because I got a forester. Where does somebody go to get to get advice about prescribed burning, and who do they turn to?
The Forestry Commission is the go-to place.
Okay.
They have what they call stewardship foresters spread out across the state, and they're there just to help landowners navigate, you know, any kind of forestry question or burning question or what have you. And they are a fantastic resource. To get information specifically on prescribed fire, they actually have a really good class that I would suggest anybody to take. If they're interested in lighting a fire, go take that class. It's just a 1-day class. It does cost a couple dollars.
Okay.
But it's a really good class. And if you complete 5 burns afterwards, you're a certified prescribed fire manager. And that affords you a little bit of liability insurance. They're basically saying, hey, we'll stand behind you. You're certified, and should something happen, you've got a little more weight behind you. They're willing to go out on a limb for you. So, like I say, it's an excellent course, and I would certainly recommend it.
That I believe that is what Rick Counts has taken. That day down in Whitmire, Rick and I kind of rode together, and he was talking about a course he's taken, and he had 2 little burns under his belt and had 3 more to go. So I think that's exactly what he was doing.
That's correct.
That's it.
That would be it. Yep.
Okay. All right. It is, you are probably one of the main pillars of the South Carolina Bob White Quail initiative. It's something you and I have talked about before, dating back to the bird dog revival over on the other side of 77,
mm-hmm.
way back, what, 2016 or so, or 15 maybe.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
What's the latest? I know you probably done your whistle counts now and
yep.
fall whistle counts. How are things looking across the state, or at least in the managed areas you've got?
Well, statewide, it's really looking up. Our whistle counts this year were some of the best we've seen. These whistle counts are basically routes that we have biologists across the state running their they stop every half mile, listen for birds for 8 minutes, and okay. If they hear birds, they write them down. And they're listening for that male Bob White call.
Right.
So we've been doing this, the whistle count, since 1979. We had never had 3-year increase in numbers since we started that until this year. So, like I say, we sort of bottomed out in 2015, but the last 3 years we've been slowly increasing. And I'm going to take that as a very positive. You know, when you've got whatever 30 years of decline,
sure.
it's nice to see a little increase.
Sure. Yeah.
We had some routes. For example, there's a route over on Fort Jackson. They had their highest count since 1991. And you know, the 90s were sort of my heyday for
okay.
quail hunting.
I
compare everything to the 90s. You know, my predecessor, Brett Carmichael, he compares everything to the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, see, that's me.
That was the golden age.
Yeah, that was me, the golden age of bird hunting as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so I'm still comparing everything to the 90s. So when we get those counts back in the 90s, I'm like, man, that's awesome. You know, we had several routes, like the MACBI WMA.
Right.
They had one of their highest counts ever. It was highest in 10 years. The Webb Center, one of their routes, it was the highest since 1991. You know, it's and you know, the Webb Center, for example, they're doing a lot of work.
Okay.
You know, I know why those are going up. You
okay.
know, the Fort Jackson, they're doing some work. They're doing a lot of red-cockaded woodpecker work, so that makes sense. But there's also routes all over the county, like over in Orangeburg, we've seen an increase. And,
okay.
and that's just on public roads out in the middle of nowhere. But part of it's, you know, all this timber that was planted in the late 90s, it's coming to an age where we're starting to do some thinning and
okay.
clear-cutting and all. So statewide, we're hearing more birds, you know, across the landscape. You know, we certainly hear them where we're doing a lot of work.
Right.
We're certainly hearing them on our quail focal areas. But as a general rule across the state, we're really hearing pretty good bird numbers. And, you know, everybody thinks about that Bob White call in the summertime, that, you know, Bob White. But
yes.
they also make another call in the fall, and it's just a fall covey call count, and it's
okay.
sort of just a cheeping little noise.
It
doesn't sound like much, but that call is probably more important to us biologists because that's a pretty good indicator of what you got on the landscape.
Okay.
Going into quail season.
Okay.
So
okay.
we monitor 8 or 10 places, and in the fall, so we know what's, like, for example, like MACBI or Webb Center or Bono Ferry, Indian Creek. We know how many coveys. We got a pretty good idea what we're looking at. So, you know, we had the second highest count at MACBI this year on the fall covey count. You know, the Delta WMA, which is a new WMA over in Union County, it's, like I say, brand new. It went from 0 two or three years ago to 8 coveys this year.
Okay.
And, you know, that's creating quail habitat out of fescue pasture.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
It's pretty cool, but yeah. So, like I say, overall, we're looking better than we were 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, if you're a bird hunter, you hate pine trees and fescue.
until
you can burn a fescue out and plant something else, or thin the pine trees, then you like it a little better.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, speaking of, we got about 3 minutes here. Speaking of, I got my invitation to go to the quail management seminar down at Webb Center. It's the 30th one y'all have put on. I haven't been in a long time. What's going to happen during those 2 days down at the Webb Center?
Well, it's for land managers, it's for foresters, it's for wildlife professionals. It's a 2-day course on how to manage for quail. You know, and I won't say that just hunters won't gain a lot of insight on quail and quail
right.
biology and quail habitats, but you know, it's more geared for folks doing work for quail.
Okay.
But it's part classroom, part field work. You get to go down and stay in the Webb Lodge. and that's, to me, that's well worth it.
That is worth the drive down there.
Just to see the grounds,
yep.
the lodge, and have some of that food.
Yep.
Like I say, but you get to do all that, but
yep.
you sit in the classroom, they cover topics, so, you know, how to manage agriculture for quail, or how to manage your forestry for quail, you know, just basic quail biology. And then we go do some hands-on stuff out in the field. Like, say, we show them what winter disking looks like.
Okay.
You know, we actually, if the weather will permit, we do a little small prescribed fire. You know, just try to get a little bit of hands-on work. So, but yeah, like I say, usually we try to limit it to about 30 people.
Okay.
And it generally fills up pretty quick. We actually just put out the invite this week. So if you're interested, just give me a shout. We'll get you signed up. It's going to be March 7th and 8th of this year.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Good time of the year to be down there before the bugs come out while it's still pleasant.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, man, Michael. Well, I appreciate you doing this for me.
I enjoyed it.
I am sure we'll do this again.
Well, I was about to say, as you well know, I enjoy talking birds and bird dogs. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you doing it, and I'm sure we'll see each other in the field sometime, and next time something comes up, we'll get back together and talk about it.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, sir. Bye. Well, there you have it. That's a lot of information that we hit a lot of topics, but Michael's just a great guy to talk to. Just a great guy. And this partnership thing, I think it's going to work good. There are two parts to it. I might have somebody, he talked about the Good Neighbor Authority. There's also a stewardship contracting part of this agreement. So maybe we'll hit that later on. And that'll do it for another week on Woods and Water, South Carolina. What a way to end it. Got some habitat, man. It's a year-round deal. You know, I can sit there in a deer stand. I can sit on the deck. I can ride the tractor, and I can plan. There's always something to do. Get involved. You manage for one thing, you manage for it all if you do it right. As always, make time to get out there. There's a lot of things going on in South Carolina. Take the back roads when you can, because that's where the state really comes alive. And don't forget that camera. See you back here next week with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Hit me from Ohio, 'cause I'm gone to